This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Hi again, this is John Williams. Happy Friday to you. Let's see how good the economic news is. We'll start with Mike Miller today, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Mike, welcome back to WGN Radio.
Great to be with you, John.
Is the economic news good in general today or not so good? What's your sort of radar
say? It seems to be pretty decent in general. You know, one thing people always worry about is the labor market, and we saw some really good news yesterday on the first-time claims. First-time claims are an early indicator of the strength or weakness of the labor market, and the fact that fewer people are essentially losing their work, losing their jobs, is a good sign. And it was a pretty substantial drop. It's a noisy indicator, but still, it's moving in the right direction. And so that's a good sign. GDP continues its upward movement. Forecasts for the current quarter, the first quarter, are very strong, somewhere between 8 and 9%. Last quarter, it was about a 4% increase. If you look at the incomes of households, mainly because of the stimulus, huge increases. So people, if they decide they want to spend the money, they're going to have money to spend. Their personal income was up one of the largest increases on record. And it's, like I say, it's a large part due to the stimulus, which we may be getting some more coming our way.
Yeah, right. It's the House is voting on it, I believe, this morning. And I think it's a foregone conclusion. Would you agree with that, that the president will sign it if the Senate passes it as well?
Oh, absolutely. He's made it clear both when he was running and after he became president that he was going to sign, and he had promised that he was going to get it to us soon. You know, I think some people have attacked him saying, you know, we were supposed to get these checks immediately. Now, it takes time to pass legislation. And so I think this has been a pretty quick turnaround. And it looks like the entire package, with the exception of the minimum wage provision, is going to go through this bill. And so there are going to be, you know, about $400 billion in checks to households. And then if the states and local governments are going to get another $350 billion to help them deal with the problems that happened during the pandemic.
Why is the increase in the minimum wage not attached to the stimulus bill? Maybe because they're different things, but I could see them putting that in there. But would that be a poison pill to the legislation?
It could be. Certainly, I think it would be harder to get it through some of the senators. The other thing was the parliamentarian, as I understand it, has ruled that it cannot go through reconciliation. It would have to be subject essentially to the filibuster that could be done by some of the senators. So I think they're probably going to strip the bill of that particular provision so that they can get the money through. And then they can offer the minimum wage, maybe different numbers or a different way of scaling it up. And they might be able to get that through Congress.
Why did you say the unemployment numbers are noisy? What does that mean?
Oh, that simply means that that based upon things like weather or local conditions or changes, like when the government of various states will change the closure rules that they have, all of a sudden there will be a big uptick or a big down movement. So noisy simply means that from week to week, the number jumps around. So what you look for is an average over, say, a four-week period to see if over 4 weeks, is the number moving in a consistent direction, either flat, up, or down. And the nice thing we're seeing is that the number is moving down, which is exactly what we want it to be doing.
Can you talk a little bit more about how much money people have, either in their bank accounts or how much they're spending? You said that it's almost unprecedented right now.
Well, that was the increase. So in other words, people can get money from various forms. They get it through earnings that they get from work. They get it through their investments. And they also get it through government grants and so forth, Social Security, and what would be in this case the stimulus package. Now, last year, when the first stimulus package was passed, personal income, the income people had to spend, jumped up dramatically because of that initial bunch of money that was sent to everybody who had a tax return the year before. And then this was the same thing before Mr. Trump left office. They were able to pass a $600 check to most of those same households. Yeah. A lot of those checks came out in January. So these people all of a sudden will be having their normal incomes from, say, people who are earning it. But also we have that huge influx of government money into their bank accounts. And then the households will decide, are they going to save that money Are they going to spend that money? And, you know, a lot of economists are convinced the growth of the economy is going to be strong going forward because there's a lot of pent-up demand. While it won't affect things like restaurants, because once you don't have a restaurant meal, that's gone forever. But if you put off buying, say, a washer or a dryer or a TV until things are looking better, and now they're looking better, people are going to dip into their savings and into their incomes, and they're going to buy some of these big ticket items.
That's interesting. A lot of economists
have strong forecasts for the rest of the year.
Well, and some of them we've spoken to, and maybe you are one of them, say, you know, this is the problem with the stimulus bill. It doesn't really forward the economy. People save the money or pay down debt. But if they're saving it to eventually spend the money, and that's in the near term, maybe it's not such a bad bet.
That is correct. And that's why I have a little problem. There's this thing I think I've talked about before called the multiplier. Of each dollar spent, how much of it goes into the economy in a form of spending, and the more that goes in, the bigger its effect upon the economy. But economists have been looking at it over only 1 2/4, and that's way too short. Because exactly as you say, households can say, well, you know, I'm not going to get this money again in the future, so I can't make a payment, for example, buy a car that I'll have a car payment for the next 5 years because I won't have this kind of money for the next 5 years. But they can stash it away, and they say, all of a sudden, I need that washer or dryer. And that will be enough money to pop for that washer and dryer that would not have been there before. And there is, we do believe, a pent-up demand for those mm-hmm. kinds of goods. And so it will be positive over time.
Well,
I think
very
the multiplier will be larger.
I'd very much like to see how that then washes out, because when they're just counting receipts, it's about 40 cents on the dollar is getting spent. Now, maybe it'll be, I don't know, 60 cents on the dollar. But I wonder if it'll be enough to persuade some people that this has been a good idea. It sounds like for some people, the jury is still out.
Well, I hear what you're saying. And the jury would have nothing to say. I mean, there would be no complaint if we knew for sure that the people who got the money were those who need it the most.
Yeah.
But that, as you and I discussed this before, that is so very difficult to do. So oftentimes you will give money to people who are, so we'd say, financially secure at the moment, not rich, but secure. But see, that kind of redistribution will allow those households, even if they do pay down debt, to become stronger. So I think the net effect on the households in terms of their long-term viability and strength is a good thing. Now, we're all going to have to pay for this, of course, over time, because the deficit's going to be larger, the debt's going to be larger, interest on the debt, and so forth. But, you know, that's why, in some sense, you have government providing such subsidies and relief during recessions, is to be there when the economy has the kind of hit that it had during the pandemic.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics, DePaul University. Always nice to talk to you, Michael. Thanks for your time today.
You got it. Enjoyed it.
Next, Greg McBride joins us, chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, John. Happy Friday.
Is it? Because interest rates are going up and I may have to pay 3.2% on a mortgage. Woe is me.
Yeah, how biased we are by recent numbers. I mean, these are, yes, we've seen mortgage rates bump up over the last couple of weeks, but they're still a quarter to almost half of a percentage point lower than they were this time last year, and still lower than anything that had been seen prior to 2020. So I think a little bit of perspective is important, but it is definitely last call for those that have been procrastinating on the refinancing. Being able to grab a sub 3% rate, that opportunity is disappearing quickly.
That almost feels like bragging rights to me, but didn't I read at Bankrate.com that it's not just the number, but it's the trend that they have been ticking up? So does that concern you?
Well, a lot of this is very consistent with what we're seeing, in the sense that the reason that the mortgage rates had fallen so low last year was because interest rates themselves were falling to record low levels, because the outlook for the economy was very bad. The expectation was that inflation would fall, price levels would, you know, might even contract. This year, we're at the other side of that. You know, now the economy is improving, and, you know, expected to see pretty robust activity, particularly once vaccinations reach mass scale. Expectation is that inflation is going to move up, not down. And so in that context, that's going to push those interest rates up. and it takes mortgage rates along for the ride.
So borrowing costs going up, well, you might not like that if you're borrowing, but that's relatively speaking a good thing.
The reasoning for the move is a good thing. You know, if you've been procrastinating on the refinance, no, it's not. If you've been looking to buy a house, yeah, the increase in rates does, you know, steal a little bit of affordability from you. So, you know, and if you're, you know, if you're a bond investor, don't look at your statement this month. It's not going to be a pretty picture there either.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what, if I were going to score the economy or the maybe the optimism for people, isn't it a little like gasoline prices? You don't want to pay more to put gas in your tank, but if the cost of gas is going up, that's telling you that there are more people out there. Businesses are prospering. It's getting better. That's why I wondered if maybe interest rates going up isn't all necessarily a bad sign.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent you know, example to tie it to is the gas prices. And yes, it's, you know, important that the reason that rates are going up is the expectation that the economy is going to do better. Now, eventually, reality is going to meet those expectations eventually. But at least for now, the expectation is the economy is going to return to the same size it was at the end of 2019 by later this year. Okay, well, where were interest rates at the end of 2019? Well, the 10-year Treasury was at 1.8%. So in that context, when we had Treasuries at, you know, 0.9% at the start of the year, 1.1 a couple of weeks ago, all of a sudden, those levels don't make a whole lot of sense with the backdrop of an economy that is expected to return to its pre-pandemic size later this year.
Greg McBride's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate, bankrate.com. Well, when will I be able to put money in some interest-bearing account that's guaranteed and is not 0.1%, is 4%? I don't know. I'm not even going to guess a number, but, you know, a number for which you would feel good about parking your money there. When am I going to get some sort of guaranteed return?
Well, you know, I think a lot of this is, you know, careful what you wish for, in the sense that at the point where those interest rates on deposits and savings products are, you know, more pleasing to the eye, mm-hmm. it's only going to be because inflation is higher too. So, you know, it's like the difference between gross pay and net pay. You know, what really counts at the end of the day is how much you're bringing home. That's what pays the bills. And, you know, from an investor's perspective, from a saver's perspective, it's, you know, the level of interest rate's one thing, but what's the level of inflation? You have to kind of consider the two in concert, and, you know, what's happening to your buying power. At the end of the day, that's what really matters. And so interest rates are really low, and inflation's been low. But at the point where, you know, the Federal Reserve feels comfortable raising short-term rates and our savings rates get better, it's only going to be because inflation has moved up and, you know, sort of put them in the position where they had to.
So unemployment notwithstanding, you like where we are right now?
Well, I mean, it depends. It's a K-shaped consumer recovery.
Yeah,
I mean, there's,
yeah.
you know, in some areas it is, you know, things are going very, very well. You know, people have saved more. They've paid down debt. Their 401k has gone up in value. But, you know, there are 19 million people collecting unemployment compensation right now. You know, there are, you know, 5% of mortgage borrowers are in some form of forbearance program. I mean, there's a ton of hardship out there, and that's not going to go away overnight. Even as the economy continues to improve, the economy may return to its pre-pandemic size later this year, but the labor market will not, and it won't for, you know, a matter of months or years, not weeks.
I'm sorry that's the case, but I'm glad you said that, because I think, especially on a show like this, that point is easy to forget. We champion some of these numbers. A lot of people ain't playing that game, are they?
No, you know, and unfortunately, and it's, you know, the long-term unemployment, I think, is the one number we're really going to have to watch as the year unfolds. We saw that coming out of the last recession, that those that had been out of work a longer period of time, they had a tougher time getting back into the labor force. And that can have, you know, long-term financial ramifications at the household level. And so I think that's going to be a key metric as this year unfolds is, you know, what's that long-term unemployment number and how quickly is that coming down, if it is.
Boy, and I don't know if anybody in any legislature is listening, but we need to find a way to target relief then better, because maybe trillion-dollar bills down the road are just going to be either unaffordable or unfeasible. They just they're too clunky. But maybe there's going to be a whole sector of the economy that still needs some help, and we ought to better find a way to slice into that part of the pie where the help is needed.
Yeah, and it's a fairly large slice. 42% of households are earning less now than they were pre-pandemic. So I think if, you know, when we speak of targeting aid, you know, that's a good place to start.
What are the numbers then on rates? Let's just go back to mortgages and borrowing right now. So what are some of the basic numbers you guys are looking at?
Well, 30-year fixed up now about 3.25%. It was 3.18% earlier this week, but we did see rates move up again yesterday. So 30-year fixed on average about 3.25% does pay to shop around as of yesterday, where there were still some sub 3% rates out there without paying any points up front. Those are disappearing quickly, but you know, still an environment where, you know, if you can lock in at 3 or 3.25, that's far lower than anything we had seen prior to 2020. So the refinancing door is still open, and you know, for the housing market, yeah, it might take a little steam out of the housing market, but you know, to me, the bigger impediment to the housing market isn't whether mortgage rates are 3% or 3.25%. It's how many homes are on the market and available for sale. You can't buy it if it's not for sale. And it's that record low inventory that I think has been the hindrance. There are would-be home buyers that are sidelined because they can't find a home available for sale in their price range.
Boy, when a house goes up, it goes so fast, and it goes at ask. It goes plus ask.
Or above.
It's amazing. Above. Yeah. You know, you're also making me think about our friend David Hochberg. He's a finance guy here, does mortgages. And we were talking about the wisdom of buying down the mortgage rate by coming in with more cash. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but it still seems to me like at 3 point something, maybe you would do something else with that money if you have it in your pocket.
Well, and the other thing is most people don't have that extra cash to plunk down. I mean, the payback period on buying points, it tends to be 5 or 6 years. The payback period on doing a refinance in the first place can be 1 or 2 years. So, you know, do the refinance, yes, but shell out extra cash to buy that rate down further. You know, I think that's a deeper consideration because of the longer payback period, because of the fact that, yes, you could probably do something else with that money. And third, because, you know, most people don't have that kind of extra cash laying around to be able to buy it down in the first place.
Greg McBride is a chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. Nice to talk to you today, Greg. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, John. Have a great weekend.
There is a business in the suburbs, and there's a few of them out there, but we'll talk to the founder and co-owner of one of them that will do the cooking for you. It used to be one of those places you'd go in and prepare the meal yourself, or they could do it, but now it's all remote. You tell them what they want or you want, and then they'll do the cooking and the packaging, and it's pretty good. So let's talk about how that business and business model is working. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Our habits of eating and drinking have changed so much. Amy Guth told us yesterday Pepsi's coming out with a cocktail mix. That's not a joke. Think about how your restaurant habits have changed and your grocery shopping habits have changed. You know who's dialed in on this a little bit is Cindy Bielek. She's the founder and co-owner of The Dinner Club. Cindy, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
So The Dinner Club is probably like it sounds, something where you guys will fix dinner for me, right?
It sure is. We do all the prep work. We take out, we help you with menu planning, and we do all the chopping. So all you have to do is cook the dinner.
There are some of those similar plans out there, but they'll give you the kit. And then if you really want to have fun assembling and chopping and cooking the dinner, you can. But some of them are more work than others, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. Yours is kind of heat and serve, right?
Yeah. We have a different variety every month. We have 14 different entrees to choose from, and it's a variety of different cooking methods, but ultimately we've done all the shopping and chopping, so all they have to do is cook it and serve it, and it's like having a homemade meal without all the fuss.
How long have you all been in business? Are you in LaGrange or LaGrange Park?
We are in LaGrange Park, right on LaGrange Road. We've been in business for 15 years. My sister and I started it in 2005. So it's been a lot of fun. We have wonderful customers, and we see all different. It works for all different types of families, whether it's a couple at home or a larger family. Our dinners serve 2 to 3 people or 4 to 6 people, depending on the size you order.
I don't know all about your business, but I do know a little bit about it because we've ordered from you in the past. I don't know if you know that, but we got...
I do.
Well, my son and daughter-in-law are brand new parents. The baby's just weeks old, and so we bought your stuff to give to them. It's like, here, guys, here's good food, and it's ready to go. I got it for my parents in Joliet because they're senior citizens. They're in their 80s and 90s. They still live at home. They don't cook much or well. And when I walk in with some of your stuff, it's like, wow, pot roast carrots and potatoes all, or a lasagna all set to go. And then Brenda and I enjoy it. Sometimes we're quite capable of cooking, but, you know, who wants to cook during a pandemic all the time? So once in a while we've used it. My point is that's three completely different types of households. And I think all of them could find a use for that. Has your business? So what's happened to business to you in 2020 and going into 2021? Was it good, flat, or maybe not as good?
Actually, it was really good. We had to change things quite a bit because we used to offer where customers could come in and assemble their own dinners. But we had to eliminate that for obvious reasons. But our pickup and delivery options have picked up a lot. So it's worked. We've seen a lot of people looking for meal solutions for their older parents and especially people that don't want to be run into the store last minute to try to prepare, you know, dinner for their family. And our dinners can all be frozen. So a lot of people will take home, you know, 8 dinners, 12 dinners, and they can freeze them so then they can pull them out as they need them. That works out really well for people.
Did it surprise you to see that the business was strong, or when the pandemic hit, do you think, uh-oh, we're screwed?
Well, you know, it was tough on our staff. We have an amazing group of people that work for us. So, you know, I think it was tough for everybody working, but it really... So many wonderful stories came out of it and people that we were really able to help with dinner. It's unfortunately the pandemic is a really good application for this type of thing where people have dinners on hand for when they need them.
Yeah.
But
what was the popular seller?
Well, every month it's something different. So we're just wrapping up our February menu. So I would say our Asian bourbon beef was really popular, but we have all different ones. Next week, we start a brand new menu, and that has a lot of great choices. Our chicken with white wine sauce is always really popular, and we try to offer variety for people so they maybe make things that they wouldn't normally make at home for their family.
You mentioned dinners of, 4 or 8, and can you just give us some price points or tell us how that works?
Sure. Our half-size dinners, they serve 2 to 3 people. We try to get closer to the 3 servings and be pretty generous. Those start at around $17.50, and it depends on the package that you get as well. And then the full-size dinners that serve 4 to 6 people are around $30. And again, it just depends on the package that they order. But they can also come in and just buy one dinner out of our fridge or freezer just to try it, too.
Mm. And so you're in LaGrange Park. Do you have a delivery network, or is it just pick up? How do I get these meals?
So they can order on our website, which is thedinnerclub.biz, and there's pickup and delivery options. And we do deliver within 30 miles of our store. There's a delivery fee for that, but we do have the ability to go pretty far. And otherwise, they can just set up a pickup time. They can pick their meals, and we'll make them custom for the customers, and they'll just come in and pick them up. And we do curbside pickup as well. And then they can always just come in and grab something if they just want to try it.
You know, a lot of the restaurants are letting you pick the food up that way, but they're also pairing it, they'll sell you a whole bottle of wine, and some of them have go containers for cocktails. Are you serving alcohol with these meals?
We don't do the cocktails, but we do have a nice selection of wines where they can just order a bottle of wine or just pick it up when they come in. But we do have a nice wine selection, and we give suggestions for pairings with each meal. But that is another option that they have.
Yeah. How many people work for your business? You said you, your sister, how many folks is the dinner club?
We have, I would say, between 20 and 25 people, a lot of part-time people. Wow. But we have a, you know, a group that's works on a daily basis. A lot of chopping and preparing the ingredients fresh for our customers, and a group of ladies that make these homemade meals. They pack them up for us. It's a great team. Yeah. Team of people. So
Cindy Bielek is the founder and co-owner of a business called The Dinner Club, and their website is thedinnerclub.biz. Here on the Business Lunch, maybe that'll help you remember the URL. It's thedinnerclub.biz, and they're in LaGrange Park. Well, good on you, Cindy. I'm glad that you've made the most out of a bad situation, and the food's pretty good, too. I'm not doing a commercial for you here, but I do know that much about your business. I'm glad things are going well.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
That's thedinnerclub.biz. Okay, it's 12:43 on WGN. The Wintrust Business Lunch continues now. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based marijuana company Verano Holdings is buying Herbal Care Center, which owns a dispensary at 1301 Southwestern. The purchase will also give Verano the rights to open another dispensary at 222 South Halsted. The purchase price is reported to be $17.5 million. The acquisition brings Verano to 10 dispensaries, the maximum allowed under Illinois law. Progressive has overtaken Allstate as the top insurer of vehicles in Illinois. This is Allstate's home turf. The company is based in Northbrook. Progressive is headquartered in suburban Cleveland. As the competition heats up, Progressive has also just cut rates for drivers in Illinois by 3%. Allstate cutting rates in Illinois by 5% on average. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's Larry Chester, the CFO, the founder and president of CFO Simplified. You can visit CFOSimplified.com to find out more from our guest. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, John. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. I know you follow the PPP program, at least the first version of it. What do you know about the second version of it?
Well, you know, the second version is really very similar to the first in that there's funds available for small companies to get money to be used primarily to cover payroll for their employees. It's a little more restrictive in that people who have received the first round of PPP loans can go and get a second round of PPP, but they need to follow a couple of very specific restrictions. They have to be small enough that they have less than 300 employees, and they have to have shown a 25% reduction in gross receipts from 2020 over 2019. And the other thing is that they had to have shown that they've used all of their first-round PPP money for the appropriate expenses for payroll.
Are there restrictions on how they can use that money, or have the rules changed at all?
No, really, the rules for that are almost exactly the same. 60% for payroll and for payroll-related expenses, and then also mortgage interest and other benefits costs that are similar to what the first-round PPP was. Those restrictions are basically exactly the same. And then the calculation for the fund that is available to you is based on 2.5 times what your monthly payroll was. The interesting thing is that they made an additional accommodation for restaurants or for accommodation businesses, you know, like hotels. In those cases, they can borrow up to 3.5 times their monthly payroll, not just 2.5 times.
Got it.
Which is what the case was for other businesses.
And then what's the payment schedule like? Is this a forgivable loan, or do they have to pay this money back?
No, just like the PPP first round, this is a forgivable loan as well, and it's basically forgivable under the same terms. The interest rate, from what I understand, is still at 1% if the loan is not forgiven. But you have the opportunity to file for forgiveness and get the entire loan forgiven if it's used for payroll or other appropriate expenses. You have to spend 60% minimum of the money that you've gotten for payroll or related expenses to be able to get forgiven. But I know a number of businesses that are getting money just strictly for payroll purposes and expect to have the loan 100% forgiven, which is really a wonderful thing for the business owners.
Does that employee that you're giving, I mean, why not, right? Even if that only leaves 40% for you, give 60% of it to your employees. Do those employees have to then be doing something? Suppose you literally can't, you know, there's not enough orders for widgets or the restaurant just doesn't have capacity. So can you be sending the check to them to sort of qualify for the program, but not actually having them work?
Well, you see, I think that's the wonderful thing about the program is that the intent is for the business owner to give that money directly to their employees. So if you're in a situation where you have employees that you've laid off because there's no work for them to do, here you have an opportunity to bring them back for between 8 weeks and 24 weeks and pay them. The money is coming from the government to be able to go into the pockets of your employees so that they have money to cover their expenses, whether that be rent or food or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
I think that's wonderful. And I know a number of businesses that brought employees back just strictly for the fact that they got PPP loans
right.
and are now able to pay their employees money.
Right, even if the shop isn't that busy or there aren't many people at the tables. So might be boring
right,
work,
exactly.
but it is work. And then what about gig workers? If I'm driving an Uber or it's just I'm doing my own thing, does it anticipate my situation? Do I qualify as well?
Well, there are situations with regard to 1099 employees who can file for their the money that they've earned during the prior year. You know, from a practical point of view, you have to be able to show that you earned money. You know, if you're, just to be honest about it, if you're being paid under the table and you're not filing taxes, then there's obviously no money available.
Yeah.
But if you're getting paid and you're filing and being paid as a 1099 worker or being paid as a solopreneur and have an LLC or a company that you're getting paid that you're using to earn money, that certainly allows you to be able to file for a PPP loan and get money from your bank. I think the banks are better able to give you specific information on that because the gig workers are a slightly different category.
All those people that have been kind of skating under the line just a little bit because it's been a cash business or cash tips and they're not claiming that money are now maybe regretting that a little bit because they can't demonstrate that the receipts are down, right?
Well, I think that's very true. But the one thing that's interesting is that for small companies that that have been filing as like a Schedule C, in other words, they're not filing corporate taxes,
mm-hmm.
but they're filing their corporate earnings as part of their normal 1099 for their personal. They're in a position now where they've changed the rules recently so that now rather than taking a look at net income, they're looking at gross income, which means sales less your cost of goods sold is what you can consider income to be able to file for the PPP and show that you had earnings. For some people who've had very small companies, their total money that they've paid out, not just for the cost of services they provide, but for the other expenses relating to the business, may have brought them down to the point where they really didn't have any income or very little income, which would have eliminated them from consideration under the program.
That's an interesting
point. Now that they've provided this, you're able to do that and still get money to be able to help yourself.
Larry, we're out of time. Is this second version, though, in place now? Like, should I be signing up for it now?
Absolutely, you should. As a matter of fact, it's open until the 31st of March. So I wouldn't wait. If you have the opportunity to file, I would do it right away.
Find out more. Visit CFO Simplified. CFOSimplified.com. Larry Chester, founder and president. Thanks for your time today, Larry.
John, thank you very much.
Well, there's a lot of information there. I'll bet he'll help you too.